first century AD onwards, is because it is argued that the despotic king draws all this wealth from the peasants and keeps it and lives in great luxury. The king is also associated with divinity, which is what gives him extra control. Quite apart from the hydraulic machinery, he's regarded as divine, and therefore there is this extra control over the peasantry. And there is an absence of commerce and urban centers of any kind, because fundamentally these are all agricultural societies, agricultural villages. Now, the notion of Oriental despotism has a tremendous history. It goes back, in fact, to the writings of Aristotle. Aristotle argues that the reason why the city-state of Athens was able to withhold the attacks of the Persian Empire in the 5th centuries and the 4th centuries BC, particularly the 5th century, was precisely because the Persian Empire was a despotic empire and people didn't have much loyalty to the king. They were forced to be loyal, whereas the Athenian democracies were democratic, in spite of the fact, of course, that the majority of the people in the city-states were slaves, that these Greek city-states were democratic and consequently were the exact opposite of the despotic Persian rulers. And this tradition then continued to be reiterated throughout European history. And the theory of Oriental despotism then becomes a very major theory to the European understanding of the Indian past. It receives an incarnation in the writings of someone whom I gather you've had much discussion on last week, Karl Marx. Karl Marx argues for a certain pattern of history for Europe, but for Asia, he argues for a totally different pattern, which he calls the Asiatic mode of production. I will be talking a little bit about the Marxist patterns of history tomorrow, but today I will simply talk about the Asiatic mode of production. The chief characteristic of the Asiatic mode of production is that there is no change in Asian society. Karl Marx goes back to the Orientalist and utilitarian idea that these societies are unchanging societies. They register absolutely no change. They're exactly the same from the year dot when they began up to the 18th century when colonialism enters. And Marx goes on to say that the stagnancy was so substantial that even though one abhors the entry of European colonialism into these areas, one can only regard it as a positive step in the long run because it is going to break the stagnancy of these societies. Now, if there is no change, then according to Marxist dialectics, there can be no contradiction in society, and society cannot move forward. As was probably explained to you, the essence of Marxist dialectics, which comes out of Hegel's philosophy, is that in every society there is what is called the thesis, which is a certain position. And out of this thesis grows an antiposition, which is called the antithesis. And through the conflict of the thesis and the antithesis, you get a forward movement which is called the synthesis. The synthesis then develops its own thesis and its own antithesis and so on. And this is really the dialectical change that takes place through time. Marx denies this dialectical change to Asian society. It's interesting that he does so because his other interpretations of history are all fundamentally concerned with the nature of dialectical change. And it shows the degree to which even someone like Marx, for whom dialectical change is fundamental, concedes the unchanging character of Asian societies by arguing for the Asiatic mode of production. Basic to this argument is, of course, the conviction that what is really responsible for the difference in these European societies and Asian societies is that capitalism emerged in Europe. And in the 19th century, capitalism was seen as the greatest feature, the greatest invention of human history. This was what had enabled Europe to emerge as the dominant power in the world. And consequently, a lot of emphasis was given to the nature of capitalism, the status of capitalism, the study of capitalism, the roots of capitalism. And the two persons who argued extensively about the roots of capitalism, one was Marx in his Theory of Dialectics, and he said that because there was a dialectical change in European history leading to the emergence of capitalism, European history is in advance of and superior to Asian history, where there has been no such change. The other person who is equally emphatic on the importance of capitalism was, of course, the famous sociologist Max Weber, writing at the end of the 19th century, the early 20th century. Weber has two studies, one of which he calls The Religion of India and the other which he calls The Religion of China, in which he attempts to analyze why there is an absence of capitalism in these areas. And of course, Weber's thesis, as some of you might know, and certainly those of you who are in business and management should know, was that it is the Puritan ethic which was responsible for the development of capitalism in Europe. That it was the Christian Puritan ethic, that is the extreme form of ascetic living, the notion of having a vocation, the notion of having a target, reaching the target, and so on, that this was extremely important to the way in which capitalism evolved in Europe. And he, as it were, turns Marx upside down, inside out, and says that it is not so much the economic factor which leads to the emergence of capitalism, it is the nature of European Protestant religion as reflected in Puritanism that forces the capitalism that leads to capitalism and creates what is called the capitalist ethic. The emphasis in both these cases is the word absence. They're both looking at a different situation. They're looking at the other, and they're arguing not in terms of what is it that constitutes the other. They're saying that this other culture has an absence of the following characteristics, which is what led to the development of capitalism and the advance in Europe. Now, so much for Europe. Let's turn back to India and see briefly what is happening in India. What is happening to the understanding of Indian history from the 19th century onwards? There is a continuation of the combination of scholarship and administration. Most of the scholars who make the major discoveries as far as history and archaeology are concerned tend to be people in the 19th century who are tied up with British Indian administration. There is, first of all, the work of two very famous engineers, one of whom was called James Prinsep, who discovered the Brahmi script, or rather who read the Brahmi script. And the other is an equally famous engineer, Alexander Cunningham, who did a great deal of work to uncover many of the Buddhist sites of northern India. Now, the interesting thing about the reading of the script is, of course, that throughout Indian history, one of the ways in which Indians have expressed themselves, or we have expressed ourselves, has been in the form of inscriptions. There is no shortage of inscriptions. Inscriptions on clay, inscriptions on stone of various kinds, on brick, inscriptions on copper, inscriptions on all kinds of materials, and right through, a large body of the reconstruction of Indian history is based precisely on these inscriptions. But the language, the script that is used, the language was to begin with sometimes Prakrit, later on Sanskrit, later on the regional languages. Pali, no, there are no inscriptions in Pali, not in India. There are some in Sri Lanka, but not in India. But the script changes. And I'd just like to take a couple of minutes to explain what I mean by this by using the board. We have the earliest script that comes from sites in India, which is the Harappa script, of which there are many, many attempts at decipherment, but none of the attempts have so far succeeded. Most people would argue that the Harappa script is what is called a pictographic script. In other words, it has symbols which can be easily read and sometimes superimposed symbols. A man carrying something, two weights, a fish. It's very easy to read these symbols. It's easy to understand some of the symbols. It's not easy to read them because they still remain undeciphered. But most people would argue that what is being conveyed is the sense of an object, of an idea, of a picture. It is not phonetic. When you get to using a phonetic script, the earliest of the phonetic scripts in the Indian subcontinent is what was called the Brahmi script. And this is partly based, it is argued, on a southern Semitic script, probably from West Asia, which traveled with traders and was adapted then to the Indian language and the Indian linguistic system. Now, what happens here is that you get, for example, in the earliest Brahmi, a character like that. We don't really know what the phonetic reading of that is. We know now that work has been done on the reading of the script, that it is, in fact, the equivalent of the present-day Devanagari A. Or you get something like that. We don't know what it is. We now know that it is, in fact, the equivalent of the Devanagari Ma. So there are really two kinds of scripts that one is talking about here, and it's important to keep this distinction in mind because very often the two do tend to get confused. Now, the evolution then of this script into present-day Devanagari took many centuries and took many forms. It gradually evolved. We can now trace the evolution, but in the early 19th century, when James Princeps was working on this, the evolution was difficult to trace, and although the pundits and the scholars were familiar with the 19th century form of Devanagari and could take it back to approximately about the 14th century, when you still can read without knowing, without being a specialist in the study of scripts, they couldn't take it any further back. So when these Ashokan inscriptions were discovered on pillars and rocks all over the subcontinent, it was impossible for people to read them originally. They couldn't understand what was written until slowly and gradually, through the process of decipherment, they began to read them as Prakrit inscriptions issued by someone who called himself Devanam Piya Piya Dasi Ashok. And even then, nobody knew who this person was because the Puranic dynastic lists simply mention Ashok and nothing more. The early inscriptions very often simply said Devanam Piya Piya Dasi. And it was only when the Sri Lankan chronicles began to be read that people realized that this was the same person as the Mauryan king Ashok, and the analysis was done. So this was the kind of very meticulous, careful scholarship that was being carried out. But behind the scholarship, the interpretation of Indian history continued to be similar to the earlier interpretations, where it was argued that the usual thing about an unchanging society and so on that I've been talking about. Alexander Cunningham did something absolutely brilliant, which was that in the 7th century AD, there was a Chinese Buddhist pilgrim that came to India, the famous Huanxiang, who wrote an itinerary of everywhere where he went. And it's a very beautifully detailed itinerary where he says, I came to such and such a town where there are so many Buddhist monasteries, so many Deva temples, and then I walked so many miles, so many li, he says, in the northeastern direction and came to such and such a place which has a very famous Buddhist stupa and so on. Cunningham literally picked up this itinerary and more or less marched in the footsteps of Huanxiang, and discovered Buddhist site after Buddhist site buried under mounds of earth which had collapsed onto these monuments. So that a lot of the rediscovery of Buddhist monuments in the middle to late 19th century started off with this kind of very literal traveling that people like Cunningham did. But wherever he goes, and wherever he writes about these discoveries, and he writes very, very interestingly in a very fascinating fashion, he always ends up by saying, I am discovering these monuments that belong to this religion called Buddhism. And by this time, even Buddhism was beginning to get a little more respectable than it had been in the beginning. But, he says, eventually my purpose is to prove that Christianity is superior to all these religions. I mean, this is really something that they can't get away from. This is there very much within them. The other major obsession, of course, was that Greek culture was absolutely superior to every other culture. So there was great excitement when coins were discovered belonging to a number of what are now called Indo-Bactrian Greek dynasties, which had their legends, as they're called, the inscription on the coin, in Greek and in Brahmi, or in Greek and another script called Kharoshti. So that it was possible to also decipher this script because they knew the Greek. And these double languages were used, and the style was a mixed Indo-Grecian kind of style. And for many years, this was regarded as the great qualitative style in Indian art because it had such a strong Greek influence. I mean, if you read Smith and if you read any of the earlier writers, they talk about the fact that, you know, this hybrid style really is something which justifies the importance of using the term art for these objects. Because for the other objects, the other images that were found, the Indo-Greek style belongs to the region of Gandhara and Afghanistan, which is way up in northwestern India. The rest of the subcontinent produced what they called monsters, images with 8 arms and 64 arms and peculiar positions and poses, which aesthetically were totally unappealing. They just couldn't make head or tail of all of this. And consequently, there was a kind of moving away and saying, let's leave this alone, until the late 19th century, when people started saying, but the essence of this sculpture is that it depicts a spiritual quality, and you're not meant to take it literally, you're meant to take it in a symbolic sense. And then these people went off on another tangent, and it all became so symbolic and so spiritual that sometimes if you try and read what they are trying to say about a particular image or a piece of sculpture, you just don't know what they're talking about because it's way, way, way in the realms of another world almost. But the administrators, again, have a certain down-to-earth quality. They're going into the districts, they're recording what they see. The major ethnography of India is coming out of this kind of recording. There is a tremendous interest in the people over whom they are supposed to be the Maibap, the people whom they are supposed to be governing, tremendous interest in their social organization, in their religious cults, in their languages, and really in many ways, again, a sea change from the kind of general run of administrators that one meets in the districts today, who have absolutely no interest whatsoever in the people whom they are governing. Whether they know anything about them or whether they're concerned about them, it's just that there's nothing but contempt for them. But this much has to be said for the British administrators, that although eventually they had contempt for this society, in fact they were curious. And for them it was also a matter of considerable pride that they had to know the region that they were governing, that they were administering, that they were administrators to. They had to know everything about it. It's again not like today where people pass through like ships in the night and are completely unconcerned with the people over whom they had this much control. Finally, 3 minutes on Vincent Smith. Important because Vincent Smith in a sense typifies, absolutely symbolizes what we call the administrator historian. He is a man who is brought up in Ireland and therefore has a slightly ambiguous attitude towards the British anyway, but is very loyal, is a good British citizen with the slight edge to him. He is brought up as a scholar in the classics. He read Greek and Latin and is absolutely imbued with this notion of, first of all, the Greek miracle. So wherever he goes, he's looking for Greek influences, whether it is in Ajanta or whether it is in Gandhar or anywhere else. He's also absolutely imbued, enthusiastic about the greatness of the hero figure, the ruler, because this is his Roman history coming up, the Roman emperors. And he is, like many people at this time, particularly administrator historians, constantly making the parallel between the Roman Empire and the British Empire. For him, the British Empire is a reincarnation of the Roman Empire. Vincent Smith is going around with Edward Gibbon's book on the decline and fall of the Roman Empire in his hand, as it were, and is looking at the British Empire and is determined that the British Empire is not going to decline and fall, and the faults that Gibbon is pointing out are not going to be repeated in this second reincarnation, as it were, of empire. Empires for him were the focus of study. They were the only things that were important, partly because of the parallel, partly because of the need to glorify empires. And so Indian history for him is not a history of stagnation. He changes the image a little bit. It is an alternation between golden ages and dark ages. So the golden ages are the empires. The first golden age is the Mauryan age, followed by a dark age of small kingdoms. The next golden age is the Gupta age, which is an empire, followed again by a large number of 5 or 6 centuries of a dark age of small kingdoms. The next golden age is the Sultanate of Alauddin Khalji, because he conquers more or less the whole of the northern part of the subcontinent right down into the Deccan, followed again by a brief period of dark ages, and then of course the Mughal Empire, which is a golden age, followed by the collapse of the Mughal Empire, which is a dark age, and then the British Empire, which is golden and resplendent beyond degree. So that this alteration of golden and dark is very, very fundamental to Vincent Smith's thinking, and also colors the thinking of a lot of historians who tend to dismiss the in-between periods as dark ages. And this is something, again, that I'll be talking about tomorrow, where there's been a very major change of emphasis. Golden ages produce great kings, and so we have this roll call of honor where he talks about Chandragupta Maurya, Ashok, Chandragupta II, Harshavardhan, Alauddin, Akbar, and so on, culminating, of course, in all the various governors, generals that ruled as part of the British imperial system. The other thing that he does in his very, what have been called the two hegemonic texts of Indian history, Mill's History of British India and Vincent Smith's Oxford History of India, the other thing, of course, is that the perspective is from the Ganges Valley. Indian history is looked at from the point of view of first Calcutta and then Delhi, because these were the imperial capitals. But the rest of the subcontinent is really secondary. What happens in the Ganges Valley is of primary importance. And for many decades after Vincent Smith wrote, there was this obsession with the Ganges Valley and North Indian history being, in fact, the effective history of India, the rest of the history not being all that very important. The division or periodization of history into these three periods of Hindu, Muslim, and British is reinforced in the writings of Vincent Smith and his contemporaries, and in fact is made even sharper than before. The change of the religion of the dynasty becomes a crucial matter of change, and within each of these periods there is no change or very little change. As we see, the Hindu period is a period of relatively little change. The Muslim period is a period of relatively little change. It is only with the coming of the British that you get a massive change, and Indian society is then drawn into, willy-nilly, it is drawn into becoming a modern society, a contemporary society, on the lines of on the lines determined by the colonial power. So that the essence of colonialism, again, according to Vincent Smith, is that it is a positive factor in the history of India. Now, how Indian historians reacted to this is really what I'll concern myself with tomorrow. It's not the craft of writing history, although historiography is involved in the craft of writing history. What I mean by this is that how does one proceed to write history? One, first of all, chooses a problem that one wants to work on. One then starts going to the sources. Now, if you're writing on the history of the 19th and the 20th centuries, then you would go to mainly literary sources, texts. Though these days, of course, a lot of people are also using what I shall be talking about, the oral tradition. That is very important. Your first step then is to collect your data, whatever data you can find. And for people like me who work on the first millennium BC and the first millennium AD, it's a bit like detective work. You have one clue and you start looking at this one clue and then you start asking a dozen questions and then maybe you'll get some answers that fit in with the other clues or maybe you won't and so on. That is the process of data collection. And then you shuffle it and arrange it and order it according to the evidence that you're getting. The interpretation of that evidence is where historiography comes in. For example, what example can I give you? If you look at the modern period of Indian history, what is called the modern period, the 19th century, let us say, you can look at it in terms of who were the governors general. So you go on listing the governors general. Or let's take a more specific example. Lord William Bentinck, who was governor general in the early 19th century and is particularly remembered for the fact that he abolished sati. This is supposed to be a great contribution to changing Indian society. Now, there are two ways of doing, or many ways of doing this. One is to say, right, whatever evidence we have on William Bentinck in relation to his attitudes to the abolition of sati, we put it together and we tell the story. In such and such a year, he talked to so-and-so who mentioned that the British should consider abolishing sati. These are the steps that he took, these are the people he consulted, and finally this was the act that was drafted for the abolition of sati. That is one way of doing it. Another way of doing it is to say, what was William Bentinck's background? Was he really interested in abolishing sati? Or did it suit British policy at that time? Did it suit British needs at that time? Therefore he went into it. Was he really in dialogue with Ram Mohan Roy? Did Ram Mohan Roy influence him or not? As a good Christian citizen, he had certain attitudes to suicide, which came out of his training as a Christian. Did those attitudes to suicide influence the way in which he might have approached the question of sati? So you start asking a whole range of other questions, and it's the way in which you set that problem in the broader context that gives the reader a clue as to the kind of historiography that you're observing. And that would be the difference. You have, for example, a book today, literally last year published, called Sati, which gives you all this information of how the British finally got to the abolition of sati. But there are also a whole heap of articles that have been written in the last 1 year, which take different positions and look at the history of sati in India, look at the symbolism of sati, look at which castes were required to, the women of which castes were required to perform sati, did this change over time, why did it change, what was the end result. So all of this, it's really, historiography is more than just putting the evidence together, it is looking at the evidence and trying to answer questions. And the kinds of questions you ask determine the kind of historiography that you're interested in. If that makes sense.
You're talking about the Aryans. Another mention was made of Aryan head, which we have heard or read somewhere. Where does that fit in, that the Aryans came from Aryan head?
Yes, well, that is, you see, the ancient Iranians have the Zoroastrians, that was their religious belief. They have these texts known as the Avasta, the Zen Avasta. Now, Old Avastan is one of the related languages, Old Iranian, is one of the related languages to Sanskrit and Greek and Latin, which forms part of the Indo-European complex. The traditional argument is that the Indo-Europeans, wherever they originated, possibly Central Asia, split into many branches and went off in different directions. One went across to the Baltic, one went to the Danube, one came down into Turkey and then into Greece, one came into Iran. And it is the Iranian branch that further split into two. One stayed behind in Iran and the other crossed over into India. And this theory is based on the evidence that we have of what is called the Shur and the Hur, or the Sir and the Hur. There are many words in Vedic Sanskrit which begin with an S, and the same word in Old Iranian begins with an H. The Rig Veda speaks of the Sapta Sindhu. The Avesta speaks of the Hapta Hindu. The Rig Veda speaks of the Asura. The Zen Avesta speaks of the Ahura. And they have the opposite qualities. The Asura in Vedic texts eventually becomes the evil one, the demon, the wicked one. In the Avestan texts, Ahura is the great god of light, brightness, goodness, and so on. So the argument was that there was not only a split into two, where there were these linguistic differences which suggested the split, but there was also a difference in the meanings of some of the words that were common to both. What has happened in this concept of Arya Meher is an attempt, again, coming back to this question of roots and identity, the attempt was made by the Shah of Iran to trace his ancestry right back to the Hakamanid dynasty, which was a contemporary of the Mauryas, 4th century BC. This was an attempt, again, at a massive identity, largely fabricated, because we know for a fact that the Shah of Iran's family does not go back to that dynasty. There isn't a continuous line. They can't trace it. You can't trace it over a period of 2,500 years. But it's an attempt to use history to make a statement of identity as well as a political statement. That's equally important. And don't forget this, that a lot of historical statements are at base political statements. And it's a question that every historian has to ask, that when I make this statement, what are my political involvements in this statement? It's a question which very few historians ask and very fewer still answer, but it is important. So that kind of link-up was suggested, that this goes back to that very early period, that there were parallel groups in Iran and in India. Now, the alternative explanation, if you don't accept the traditional theory of the Aryan race, is, of course, that this whole area from the Euphrates to the Indus, archaeologically speaking, is an area for which we have evidence of much coming and going. There are groups traveling all the time, herders, pastoralists, migrants, traders, tremendous activity going on. So that it is quite possible that you would have similar languages being spoken in two adjoining areas like Iran and India, without necessarily having to posit the coming down of a race of Aryans from Central Asia or from the Danube or wherever, or even the going out of a race of Aryans from northern India into Iran. You don't have to posit that kind of large-scale movement. These linguistic similarities and differences can be arrived at through a much smaller-scale migration of groups over time for reasons not having to do with conquest, but simply having to do with herding and trading and moving.
That there is a theory, especially in Eastern Europe, I heard, you did mention
just now, when people from India travel to Iran and the center of the Indo-Aryan group is India itself.
No, that's not my view, but that is the view that some people, yes, yes.
Now, the reason given is that Sanskrit, the roots are much stronger, and therefore this is the basic language, and it's like the root in this statement?
Not really. I mean, the thing is that this statement has to take into consideration, which it doesn't, that the oral tradition of preserving Sanskrit has been much stronger in India. It's not so much the original roots that are stronger, but that it has a stronger tradition than other languages preserved elsewhere, which have tended to get mixed up much, much more quickly.
But I think the way Will Durant acknowledges
that... I'm sorry, I don't accept Will Durant as a scholar. Let's be very clear about that. I draw the line there. Will Durant is a popularizer who has absolutely no scholarship at all in anything Asian. His scholarship, anyway, whatever it is limited to America and a bit of Europe.
About coming to Iran, I think the name itself is derived from Aryan. Is Aryan, Iranian, Iran?
No. It's yes. It's derived from Iran. Is a much later word that is used. It's not derived from Aryan. And I know that I at the moment don't remember the exact etymology, but it certainly isn't Aryan. I don't think so. Aryana. Yes. No. These etymologies, you see, this was one of the problems with your 18th and 19th century Orientalists, that very often they argued on the basis of a similarity of sound, what is called philology. And they developed a subject called comparative philology, where if the sound is similar, you argue that the two languages are related. Now, that theory is today totally unacceptable. People in linguistics will say that you can only say that two languages are related if the linguistic pattern is related. In other words, the structure of grammar and the structure of vocabulary, you have to go into that. It's much harder work than what it was in the 19th century. And certainly on that basis, many of the old theories about the relationships of language, simply because words sounded alike, that doesn't hold.
So the thing is, sometimes, if you examine the Polish people who are very much living in Iran, Yugoslav, and Turkey, their language structure, particularly counting and such, is very much Sanskritized.
Mm-hmm.
And those people are not supposed to be moving around or traders.
But they are herders, and herders are probably some of the most migratory people imaginable. The Kurds are herders and have been for centuries.
And they always say that our culture is very much similar to
Indian. No, that's a popular belief. I mean, it's like the whole theory about the gypsies. They are also supposed to have originated in India because they have the first five numbers are similar to the numbers in Sanskrit, and they have a few other words here and there. But you know, these things can be accidental. One has to be very careful to make these linkages.
On this, one is the archaeology, work in India. I thought was maximum, or at least got started around the time of Lord Curzon and Mohenjo-daro and Harappa. I thought was Lord Curzon's I don't know whether there was any evidence of earlier efforts on those directions. That is one. I mean, their contribution, I thought, towards archaeological evidence of which he was somewhat reflected. The second is that what were the Indians doing during that time? I mean, why is it that, shall we say, we allow somebody to create a history we didn't think, at least today we don't think of them as. The second question, of course, pertains to Max Muller. I just want to hear something about the contradiction that you mentioned about Max Muller.
the contradiction?
Contradiction in terms of this various knowledge and not wanting to listen.
Ah, I see, yes. Okay.
Not doing this question, you add a small comment of mine. You spoke of Gobineau, you didn't mention how he chambered the foundations of the 19th century.
Later, yes, yes.
You raised things like that with Malala and all these But Max Muller wrote so enthusiastically about this. But how is it his contemporary Nicole, who came to India, studied so much, this the whole of Indian culture as just sitting here. I thought he was a much more learned man, or more balanced man. But is that an incorrect?
Right, archaeology, yes. The first person who takes an interest in archaeology is Alexander Cunningham, which I mentioned, you know, this business of going up to a mound and trying to discover what the mound contains. This is, we're now talking about sort of 1860s. There's a little bit of tapping of sites, but nothing very substantial. Curzon does take a lot of interest. He sets up, the Archaeological Survey of India is set up. Curzon, in fact, has a very interesting passage where he talks about it is our mission in this country to dig and to discover, to cherish and to conserve and to preserve and something else and so on and so forth. But the important thing is that in all of this, the idea behind the interest in archaeology consists of two things. One is that it is an interest that is developing in Europe at this time. Archaeology is becoming very much a subject that people are getting enthusiastic about because this is another way of discovering your roots and your identity. So it's the fallout effect. It's happening in Europe. Therefore, people are interested in the archaeology of Asia. Attached to this, this is also the late 19th century, the early 20th century, is the archaeology of the Middle East. The discovery of the great cities of Babylon, of Nineveh, of Ur, of the Chaldees, and so on. The archaeology of the Middle East is tied to the Bible. It is an effort to prove that the events of the Old Testament are historically accurate. So there are archaeologists running around saying there was a great flood and this Noah's Ark story is not made up or that kind of thing. So what is called biblical archaeology is tied into the discovery of remains in what was then called the Near East or what was today would be West Asia, particularly Mesopotamia. Mesopotamia coming to the Mediterranean Sea, which is the area where biblical archaeology was, where the Bible, the events of the Bible are centered. So as a fallout again of that, the argument is, well, what was happening in India? Let's try and find out. Is it a totally different story altogether? The discovery of Mohenjo-daro and Harappa is accidental. It is made by Indian archaeologists. The excavation is then carried out by John Marshall, but the original discovery was by Indians who were employed in the archaeological survey who were exploring the area and came across these bricks that were being used for a railway line that was being set up. And they looked at the bricks and said, they look different from the normal bricks. The size is different. And the villagers said, yes, there's a great mound of bricks over there. We've been bringing them from that mound. And they walked to the mound, and the mound was Mohenjo-daro. And a substantial number of bricks had already been taken away for the building of this railway line. But that has nothing to do with Curzon. That's an accidental discovery in some ways. With all of this, the point that I'm trying to make is I'm not denying that there was an immense amount of effort put in by the British in terms of rediscovering the Indian past. That is not to be denied at all. An effort which is extremely meticulous as well. They're very careful. You know, they don't run off with fancy theories and so on. They're quite careful about how they handle the data. But behind this, the major thinking is still one of, this is a civilization which doesn't really come up to Greek standards. This is a civilization that we have to be more knowledgeable about because we are governing it. The British are not looking for their identity in Indian civilization. It's the Indians who have to look for their identity in that civilization. So that the interpretation of this data is conditioned by a different set of factors. There isn't that investment in the interpretation which we make today, because for us it's absolutely vital. The past is vital to our present. The Indian past was not vital to the British present to the same degree. And I think that's one of the reasons why you get this, really, in a sense, a break between actually finding the evidence and taking the trouble to ask the kinds of questions that they were asking about the evidence from archaeology in Europe at this time. Even those questions are not asked, because there it is vital, it's crucial, it ties in with their identity. Your second point is certainly very well taken. What were the Indians doing? Why didn't they move in and write their own history? And this really has to do with two things. One is the point that I made right at the beginning, that the Indian tradition of historical writing was a very different tradition, where there was much more interest in things like genealogical lists, claiming legitimacy to rule. One of the most interesting things that's coming up now, for example, is that in most cases, dynasties that claim Rajput origin invent a whole genealogical tree for themselves, linking themselves with the heroes of the Ramayana or the Mahabharata, as the case may be. Very interesting. Now, this is not to be scoffed at, because it does present the whole point of, you know, what is the origin of this? Most Kshatriyas, let's say, why just Rajputs? Why single out the Rajputs? Most people who claimed Kshatriya origin from about the 6th century AD onwards are suspected of being people who really weren't of very high status, managed to work their way up the scale. When they become independent, not before, when they become independent rulers, then they resort to claiming Kshatriya status. And there is a very interesting mechanism by which this status is bestowed on them, and society accepts it. Now, the point that I'm trying to make is that that kind of approach to history is very different from the post-Renaissance European approach, which says, where are the books that say history started in such and such a year with such and such an event, and then so-and-so came to rule, and they fought a battle over there, and then X came to rule, Y came to rule, and so on and so forth, and the whole narration of events. We do have texts like that. The most famous is a text that comes from Kashmir, which is called the Rajatarangani, written by a Kalhana, a very, very brilliant historian, in fact, in the 11th century, sorry, in the 12th century. Now, they all accept the fact that there is this one text, and they say, isn't it strange? There are no other texts. But if you go into the history of the small kingdoms, virtually every kingdom from about the 11th, 12th centuries onwards had what was called a Vamshavali. And the Vamshavali was precisely that. It was a history of all the dynasties that had ruled in that area. But what the British were looking for was a history of India. Now, the concept of India didn't exist at that time. And therefore, what the Indians were also looking for, in a sense, the Indians trained by the British, was a history of India. That didn't exist. Now, what you don't get until the middle of the 20th century is Indian historians saying, maybe we wrote our history in a different way. It didn't have to be written in the European way. It didn't have to be written in the Greek way. Maybe...
Sorry, but it does appear that the extent to which we rely on Chinese sources, would imply that other civilizations did have a more systematic rendering of history, maybe even the Greeks and the Romans, and we just don't seem to have that. Otherwise, why would we rely so much on the Chinese? No, we don't rely, well, let's take that particular source, the 7th century AD.
Yuan Sang comes to India during the reign of Harshavardhan. We rely on the Chinese source because he gives us a description of the places that he went to and a very good geographical itinerary. But this is also the same period, the same reign, where we have a very major biography of Harshavardhan written by Banabhatta called the Harshacharita, which is a poetical account. But what happened was that it got dismissed in the 19th century as being sheer poetry. Oh, you can't take that seriously. This is a court poet who's writing, and he writes in this florid style. He only has nice things to say about Harshavardhan. He describes him as a great king and this, that, and the other. This is not history. What we are now doing is saying, let's put that text into its context. He is a court poet. He is writing in a florid style. What are the little clues that he's giving us as he goes along? So that what we're really trying to do is to take the text and analyze it sentence by sentence in terms of the history of that period, as we know it not only from the Chinese traveler, as we know it from Harshavardhan's own inscriptions, which have since been read and deciphered, as we know it from this text, as we know it from a whole lot of other bits and pieces of poetry and narrative that were written at that time. So that what is really happening is that it's not that we don't have the material. It's not that we didn't have that kind of historical material. It is simply that there was a dismissal of this kind of material as being historically valid. Yes, they are available. They are available in the Puranic texts. Now, what is interesting about the Purans is that when they start talking about dynasties, they are reasonably accurate. The period from certainly the Nandas, which is the 4th century BC, to the Guptas of North Indian history, they're pretty accurate. They give dynasty by dynasty. All they do is to say such and such a dynasty will rule, the following kings will reign, this dynasty will give way to this dynasty, the following kings will reign. Nothing more. No information on what they do or anything of that kind. That information all comes to us from the inscriptions. Now, again, in the 19th and 20th centuries, people ignored the inscriptions. You have from about the 7th century AD onwards, and certainly from the 9th century AD onwards, a massive body of inscriptions all over the Indian subcontinent recording grants of land. Kings who came to rule very frequently made grants of land either to high administrative officers, where they were permitted to collect the revenue of the land in lieu of salary, or to learned Brahmins. And very often it was these Brahmins who were concocting the genealogies for these kings, so it was a good payoff. These inscriptions come by the hundred. They were deciphered around the end of the 19th century. And literally, until about 30 years ago, the only use they were put to was, what information do they give us on the king, on the date of the king, and the dynasty that he belongs to? That's all. Then historians started saying, but that's only the first 6 lines of the inscription, and some of these inscriptions run into 30, 40, 50 lines. What is all the rest? The rest is your basic data on the grant, the kind of land it is, the nature of the grant, the caste of the person to whom the grant is given. There's a whole construction of the social and economic history of India, which is based on that same inscription, that same data, which was dismissed because historians were narrowly only looking at dynastic history and chronology. That was the obsession that they had been trained. History means chronology and the narrative of dynasties. So that's all historians looked for. And this happens everywhere. I mean, this is not just Indian history, this is European history too. After all, European history right up till the early 20th century was primarily only concerned with dynastic history. And consequently, it's not that we didn't have the historical writing. We didn't really look for these kinds of sources. Now that we're looking for them, they are beginning to sort of come up all over the place. I mean, every temple has its little history, its potted history. Every place of pilgrimage has its history, which sometimes you take something like this whole controversy over Ram Janmabhoomi. There is an Ayodhya Mahatmya, which goes back to the 12th century AD, which describes the pilgrimage, where the Janmabhoomi comes in very much later, of course. So that we know from this text that there was no such place as Ram Janmabhoomi before the 12th century AD. It's an invention of the later period. So that, you know, when you go into these kinds of sources, you begin to reconstruct local history at a level which makes it very relevant to the broader concept of history. Nevertheless, that is still a question. Why is it? And one suspects that the two reasons for that is that, first of all, the European scholars were not interested in these texts. They were regarded as second rate because their main informants were the learned Brahmins. And to the learned Brahmins, all that mattered was the Vedic texts. You first learn and understand the Ved. You then learn and understand the six systems of philosophy. Later on, you may go to the Puranic texts. Later on, you may go to the Agamic texts. And as for Vamshavalis and Mahatmas and so on, you know, they're below our... they're contemptuous. They're local stuff. We're not interested. So the European scholar is also pegged on to Vedic texts and philosophical texts and that kind of thing. And it's only much later that there is an interest taken in local texts. The Indian who was involved in the understanding of what we would call history was very often not the Brahmin, but the bard. The Bhat and the Charan in Rajasthan, the Bharot in Gujarat, the Sut, various other people all over, the Bardic, the Pandas in places like Haridwar and so on. These people are again not respected because they're not Brahmins or they're a low status Brahmin. Therefore, if there had even been an appeal to Indians to come forth with their histories, there would have been a tendency to say, yes, but this is really not first-rate history because it comes from sources that really aren't socially absolutely off the top. And this whole business about societal attitudes to your sources is very important in history. And it's something, again, that I'll be talking about a little more tomorrow when I talk about the use of the oral tradition in relation to the writing of modern history. Max Müller. Now, I'm sorry if I gave the impression that Max Müller was positively refusing to come to India. What is interesting about Max Müller is he stays put in Europe. He gets himself a very coveted professorship of Sanskrit at Oxford University. He's quite willing to meet every Indian of any intellectual status who comes to England and have a long chat with them about India. And he goes on saying, it's a great shame that, you know, I wish I could come to India, but there's always an excuse. If it isn't this, it's that. If he's not well, he's too busy, he's this, he's that. What I'm trying to get at is that you have in the early 19th century, these two absolutely sort of towering intellectuals as far as Indology is concerned. Max Müller, teaching Sanskrit at Oxford, James Mill working as an officer of the East India Company in London. Both of them generalizing madly about India. I mean, you know, at the drop of a hat, they will say India is this, Indian society is this, Indian is this, Indian history is this. But they are not taking the trouble to come and get a first-hand view. Now, I'm just interested in why. Is it because the understanding of European scholarship at that time was one in which it really didn't matter what was happening in the colony. We had the answer. We had the methodology. The emphasis was so much on if we had the technique of analysis, we don't have to go. We don't have to find out. We can do it sitting over here. That is one way of looking at it. The other way of looking at it is simply to say that there was a feeling of, even on the part of Max Müller, basically one of these are second-rate cultures. However much we may glorify them, fundamentally they had not made it to capitalism, to European advance, etc., etc. You know, they're nice, passive, quiet, gentle little village communities. Leave them alone. I don't have to go and visit them. So that is really what I was meaning. Not that he positively refused in the sense that it was not that somebody sent him a ticket and he sent it back kind of thing, But it's a kind of reluctance on the part of these people sitting in Europe to even feel that maybe if they went, and I think that reluctance has to do with the point that I was making earlier on, that even the scholars of the East India Company, when they are talking to the pundits in Calcutta, they're talking only about that text. They're not talking about the context. They're not really interested in the life of these people. The Asiatic Society is founded for carrying out research into the Indian past and present, into India. For the first 50 years of its existence, almost 47 years, no Indian is allowed to become a member of the society. I mean, it's an absurd situation. You're using Indian informants. And sometimes you're being fooled by these informants. There's one famous case of a pundit who changed the manuscript and rewrote it so that everything read as if it was happening in England. And this poor Francis Wilford, who was reading this manuscript with the pundit, really believed all this and said, "My God, you know, the ancient Indians knew all about Europe and England," until he realized that he was being fooled. He's smart enough to realize that he was being fooled. But that was the degree of dependence. And yet, when it came to research, there was this confidence that we know the technique, we know the method. And it's the confidence that sometimes worries me, because it's the confidence that we have now. You know, for example, I'm speaking of the social sciences, and I should imagine it's the same in the sciences. The confidence that if you've got the technology and the method, the context doesn't matter. And that's a worrying thing. That's something I would...
This point that you raised about the Britishers confining themselves to getting the actual meaning and not taking the trouble and the opportunity to really know what their point of view was. Isn't it quite possible that it was a deliberate attempt, because the tendency to then, for the pundits to interpret it, like the example you gave, of course he carried it into Epstein, Livingston, Walcott, but the chances of interpreting it in a way it was not intended to.
Surely. Yes, surely. In fact, this is why a lot of people are suggesting that, for example, let me give you an example. There is a translation of the Manu Dharmashastra into English, which was done by George Bueller. He quite indiscriminately, and this is no fault of his, because in those days there wasn't that fineness of meaning, translates Varna, Jati, Jana, Kula, Vamsha, all as either caste, tribe, clan, class, division, whatever, indiscriminately. Now, we know today that Varna is very different from Jati, Jati is very different from Jana, Jana is very different from Kula, Kula is very different from Vamsha. Each of these words has a technical meaning. But in this English translation, it is indiscriminately translated as any one of these. Now, partly it is that the informant was not being precise. And, you know, when the word Vamsha comes along, the informant says, yes, family. Whereas Vamsha never means family. It means succession. So it's translated as family. Partly, of course, that there isn't that fineness of understanding that these words all had a specific meaning. Because of the nature of Indian society, where, for example, jati is a crucial thing. I mean, as Andre Vetai must have explained to you last week, that it's absolutely fundamental that you understand what the word jati means, otherwise you don't begin to understand Indian society. So it's a mixture of the two. And they don't ask that question because they're looking at these texts from the point of view of European society, where, you know, where one's born is a vague concept. By now, the aristocracy is scattered, birth is unimportant. It's where you've got to that identifies you. It's success in life that identifies you. And all these chaps that come out, it's very interesting if you read their biographies. Most of them are children of families, most of the Sanskritists or the scholars or the people that come out on the East India Company are children of families where they can't make it to the top in England for whatever reason. And they're sent out to make their fortune. They're as corrupt as can be. They do all this. They all go back with fortunes because this is the purpose of coming out to India. You join the East India Company and you come out for 10 years. You make your fortune, you go back, you buy a little stately home in England and you retire. So that You have to take all this into consideration when you're trying to reconstruct the kind of knowledge that they are reaching out to. You're absolutely correct in saying that probably the pundits confuse them even further by giving their own interpretation of the text and not saying that there may be other interpretations which needed to be looked at. Macaulay. Yes, Macaulay is a very interesting character again, because I think he is the extreme of the utilitarian philosophy person. You know, he takes James Mill as his basic text and goes even further along the lines that Mill would normally have suggested. I think Macaulay's problem, and the reason why Macaulay was dismissing the whole sort of compendium of Indian culture, was because Macaulay was very deeply involved in this debate on Orientalism and Anglicization. And for him, it became really an issue of life and death. He was fully convinced that the British could not rule in India unless they switched to English and changed, you know, the whole system to a system that would be based on the use of the English language, the use of English institutions, the use of the British context for governance. And I would say that it's really more his political involvement in this debate that led him to take such an extreme position, rather than any really fundamentally intellectual concern that trying to understand a different culture.
Last week we were told that our caste system has a continuity with few other similar systems anywhere in the world. To what extent is our caste system historically continuous, and where are the discontinuities in the sense that it's not really the same system we know today, which is so many thousand years ago?
Let's say that the system is continuous as a system of social organization. That doesn't mean that the castes have a continuity.
But the top dog
remains? No, not necessarily. I mean, the top dog very often has to recruit the local pariah, which is why to talk about purity of castes today is nonsense. We know that even the top castes are pretty mixed. But when I say this, I should also add that there are changes that take place historically within the system as a system of social organization. Unfortunately, no one's really done a history of caste, because this idea of change in caste is an idea which historians are only now beginning to understand a little bit. Up till now, it was very convenient. One said, oh yes, as far as society is concerned, the caste system came into existence with the Vedic period, and after that it just continued. It was like being on a rail track. It just went on and on and on. Nothing changed. Now we know that there were changes. And in order to understand those changes, really, it's necessary to look at the history of jatis rather than varna. And that is the other very major thing that has come in, that historians now speak less and less of looking at the varna divisions of society, because varna, in a sense, is an ideological model. It's not the actual working, except at the top end or the lower end. The distancing between the Brahman and the untouchable is certainly very real. But between that, who is a Kshatriya, who is a Vaish, who is a Shudra, varies from region to region. I mean, the work that is to be done theoretically by these three groups is certainly uniform. Every Dharma Shastra will describe it, every Puran will describe it. But exactly which local castes constitute which, and whether in fact this system of the five groups occurs in every part of the country, is a big question mark. For example, the area that I come from, the Punjab, the Brahmin caste has a very marginal existence, and there are virtually no Kshatriyas. It is the trading communities that are the dominant caste. And so it completely, when you look at the reality of it, it turns the whole thing askew when you begin to wonder what is really going on. So that it makes much more sense historically to say that one is interested in the history of jatis. And there again, the basic data is inscriptions, which tell you exactly which jatis are doing what in particular periods.
But the top echelon of the jatis, which one thinks it were also involved in setting the norms for the rest of the jatis, means who will be what was decided presumably by those top echelons.
Not necessarily. It's sometimes decided by a particular occupation of a jati which becomes economically very lucrative. Now, this is again something that I will talk about later, that tied into the whole business of caste organization is the notion of patronage. And you do get situations where Shudras are patrons of Brahmins and they set up temples where the Brahmins are performing worship for a Shudra patron, because they've made it to an economic point where they can afford to be patrons.
But I think that is a system which is common in ancient India.
No, it's not common in ancient India. It is, the, for example, if you look at the Dharma Shastras.
But the name of the Brahmin in the state is called Purohit. One who takes care of the interests of the
No. Well, by the 15th and the 14th century, in some parts of the peninsula, you begin to get references to Brahmins conducting services. Yeah, yeah. But that was not the case earlier. If you look at the Manu Dharma Shastra, it's quite clear that Brahmins are not to conduct services for the Shudras, are not to receive any gifts from the Shudras. But when you start looking at the later Dharma Shastra, that is, for example, the commentary on Manu, the commentary of Medhatithi on Manu, which is the 10th century AD, the position changes. So the point is really that precisely one of when a person is in a position to become a patron, then obviously gifts can be accepted. But before that, no, there is a distinction.
I have one other question. We are saying that the English colonials, they were representing the European model. What I feel is that English had no interest of interfering in Indian culture or Indian region as such. They were mainly interested in listening to the English. So don't you think that their interpretation of the Indian religion was more neutral and was not really based upon the European model?
Remember that the British were here as a political power. They were here in political authority. They were the colonial rulers. All rulers have an interest in the interpretation of history, whether it's their own history or the history of their people. So that no ruling power is neutral in the interpretation of any aspect of the culture of the society that that ruling power is controlling. There is bound to be a linkage between the two. Some people would go to the extent of arguing, and here this is again something I will be discussing later on, that the construction of Hinduism as we know it today is a construct which really goes back to the colonial period. Right, I'll be discussing this in my fourth lecture, so we can have a nice discussion on that.
I would just like to mention, I'm inclined to agree that history is being utilized like that. Irrespective of whatever the colonial history is written for India, I think in the 19th century, the British were also writing a new history for them in England itself. I think the case of Piltdown is one such case.
Well, that's the use of archaeology. Oh, surely, yes. They are writing a new history because, let's face it, I mean, British society is changing in the 19th century and there are new groups that are coming into power. So their history and their search for identity is very different from the previous century. I mean, your landed aristocracy is moving out and you've got new groups coming into power. So their interest in history is again very different. Yeah. It's different for Britain, for Britain as well.
Could explain the Piltdown a little bit.
Piltdown, I think the old man.
The skull.
Piltdown,
That's a fraud. No, no, I think this was part practical joke and part tied into Darwinism.
Whatever it is, I think somewhere in the 50s were writing about that, early 50s.
When they discovered that it was a fraud. Yes, yes. Yes, yes.
They were saying that the 19th century archaeology was
Well, in the 19th century, the dominating ideas of social Darwinism in the 19th century, which saw all societies along a continuum, moving from the primitive to the less primitive and so on, to the most advanced, which was capitalist Britain, capitalist France, northwestern Europe. The same thing that I was talking about when I referred to Marx and Max Weber, arguing that the peak of human achievement is capitalist society, and there's been an evolution. So every other culture and society has to be fitted on the scale somewhere. And colonial societies were always fitted lower down the scale. Now, in order to prove the effectiveness of this advance, it was not enough simply to talk about industrialization and political control and colonialism and then imperialism and so on. It was also necessary to have a past in which you could show this gradual evolution. So the fabrication of the Piltdown skull is part of this process of the gradual evolution of British society. It's tied into Darwinism, basically. Yes.
We've learned a lesson, so to speak, from what Indian historians had not recorded of the previous history. Could you tell us what is happening currently?
What is happening currently? About?
About recording and history.
Oh, I'll be discussing that tomorrow. Okay. Yeah.
I was wondering.
Just a second.
I just wanted to share the one experience I had. A book has been published, it's called The World Religion. It has been published by Oxford University about 4 years ago. It contains 200 pages. And it is about 84-85. And I was just going to the Department of History and I'm trying to look into the book. The Indian religion came, Hinduism, only a few pages, or 200 pages. And the first statement in that particular book of Hinduism, the Hindu word, the first word. So I just wanted to
sorry, what was it?
Hindu word is the first word.
Parsi.
Parsi.
The Hindu word is the first word. And that's the first person actually struck me very well. I wanted to know, this really reflects what kind of the approach the colonial power has given that clearly reflects in the Holy Spirit. The second, the really the word Hindu has come from Parasa, or is it really the ethos in fact there, and other way say Sindhu rather than a Hindu?
Yeah, well it wasn't there. It's quite correct. The first time that the word Hindush is used is in an inscription by an Achaemenid king in Persia. The reference is not to the religion, the reference is to the area, to the land. That is the Indian, North India at least, if not the Indian subcontinent, is called by the Sindhu River. And since there is this S and H interchangeability that I talked about earlier, the Persians always refer to it not as Sindhu, but Hindu. But the reference is a geographical reference. That is the earliest use of the term. Again, I'm sorry, I will be discussing this in the fourth lecture, but let me give you a very brief summary now. There is no reference to Hindu in any Indian text, and in any indigenous Indian text until the 15th century. The next reference after the Persian is in Arab accounts, again, to Al-Hind and Hindu as the land across the Indus. Al-Hind is again a geographical term. Hindu, as used in the original Arab accounts, is to the geographical area across the Indus. And it is from that usage that you get from a geographical terminology, it becomes the terminology of the people that live in the land across the Indus. And from that, it comes to be used for the people practicing certain kinds of religions. And it's only in the 15th century, for the first time, that you get a reference in Indian texts to Hindu. But this is, as I say, a point that I will be discussing later. Sorry, there was a question here.
Yeah, it's not clear to me the usual division of Indian history into the Hindu, Muslim, and Jewish period is to be discarded. Why has it become so unacceptable? I know that these periods did begin at the same time in various parts of the country, but in terms of their cultural influences,
may I leave this till tomorrow, because I will be talking about it tomorrow.
Coming to the defense of Nakarin, I would say that it was Nakarin who laid the foundation of an independent India. Whatever we are today, it is due to the introduction of English language and the universities in different parts of India. The legal system which our independent government have not been able to replace till now. And do we say that the British, they may have their own reasons, but they created a united India. India, as we understand today, did not exist before British India. I think I need your opinion about
it. Yes, they created a united India up to a point. Let's not forget that they were also responsible for the partition of India into India and Pakistan, possibly also India, Pakistan and Bangladesh, and who knows what else. It's true, certainly. And it's not just English. It is, after all, the creation of the Indian middle class. And the national movement, at one level, is the movement of the middle class in India. It has, of course, a manifestation in among other groups as well, but the main thrust of the movement for independence is that. Nationalism is also something that comes with a change in the way in which a society organizes itself. And it has been argued that, for example, nationalism in Europe is tied to industrialization. And it could be argued, as some historians have argued, that in India it is not so much the English language as industrialization which the British introduced, which was carried forward by Indian entrepreneurs, such as the one who set up this establishment, which is part of the generating force of nationalism. And I think this is correct historically. You can't pin it down to one factor. It's a whole series of factors. But let us not also forget that much as these factors led towards the coming together of different parts of the Indian subcontinent, there is a long historical memory of separation. And it's that memory of separation and separate identities which is also playing a role, and as we know today, it's playing a very forceful role, unfortunately, or fortunately, depending on which way you go as far as Indian nationalism is concerned. So that, in a sense, nationalism is the creation of the British. In a sense, the coming together of the Indian subcontinent is the creation of the British. The coming together of the Indian subcontinent is assisted very strongly by the anti-British movement of nationalism. But the coming to terms with a historical past is something that we still have to face. And I don't know where that's going to take us. I'd rather not predict.
Going back to some earlier topic, you were discussing of this frustration that people have trying to place a common racial background. Other than trying to historically prove or improve, trying to genetics, does it lead to any help in trying to break out commonality between the races?
I don't know that it's really been tried. I mean, at least not in the Indian context. Again, you see, the problem is that the science of genetics can only deal with the 20th century, that at the end of the 20th century. I mean, what happened earlier, we don't know. Yes, absolutely, absolutely. Which some historians have been saying anyway from other evidence.
Why horribly? Tremendously.
A big case of separation, horribly.
Yeah. Yes.
See, if we, as we know the history of India, from time Rajendra first attacked and then there was a change and then Indian was changing, then again there was a Bhakti, then somebody else came. And we have been finding that there have been constant constant rule by outsiders in India, more or less, starting from
they know. No. He never ruled.
But he did create an atmosphere where some part of North India, like Afghanistan, part of Punjab, was also ruled by the when General Gupta.
Hardly, well, for 10 years. I wouldn't. The Muslims are not foreigners, I'm sorry. I take very strong objection to that.
I'm not saying foreigners in today's
context.
They came. Initially they came.
All right.
Later on they got
weak. Yes.
Apart from the British came. Actually, of course, even not then
the British are foreigners. They were not white. The British are.
What I'm saying is, it's a debatable point. But what I'm saying is that. Have the historians studied the various characteristics of the Indian society as historical? What are the factors which have led to such a climate where we have been staying for almost 1100 years? And what are we going to do that in future at least this thing is not repeated?
Ah, who knows about the future? First of all, I don't accept your basic premise that we have been ruled by foreigners. Let's go through the dynasties. Systematically, the major dynasties. Who were the foreign dynasties that ruled here? The first lot of foreigners to rule were the Indo-Bactrian Greeks, 1st century BC. No, I'm sorry, I've been trying to prove to you that there was really no such thing as a vast horde of foreign Aryans who came in and settled down. Yeah. All right. So, yes, all right, so let's forget about that because that, if not, unaccepted is at least controversial. The ones that we know of, the Indo-Bactrian Greeks who ruled from the 1st century BC to the 1st century AD in the extreme northwest of India with a few incursions down as far as Mathura and Allahabad for a very brief period.
Was that called the Gandhara region?
No, the Gandhara region is way up north of Peshawar. Okay. So that's in one part of the Indian subcontinent for 200 years. The Shakas came in from outside. We don't know whether they were in fact foreigners or whether they weren't already very mixed with Indian populations along the borders of what is present-day Pakistan and Afghanistan. The other major group that comes in from outside is the Kushans that come in from Central Asia. Rule for 200 years, again in the northern part of the country, coming down to Mathura at most. That's it. Then you have the Turks and the Afghans.
Mongols.
Briefly, the Mongols. The Mughals. All right. Now, all these people, you're leaving out then, the Nandas, the Mauryas, the Shungas, the Kanvas, the Satavahanas, the Ikshvakus, the Meghas, the Vakatakas, the Guptas, the Chalukyas, the Rashtrakutas, the Chedis, the Kalachuris, the Pallavas, the Cholas, the Cheras. You're leaving them all out. And they're the ones who've been ruling from the 4th, 5th centuries BC right up to the 18th century in some cases. Now, you know, the problem about this foreign rule business is that, first of all, it takes as its perspective northwestern India and generalizes about the whole subcontinent from what happened in northwestern India. I think it's about time we realize that when one talks about Indian history, the northwestern part of the Indian subcontinent is only a small region.
But sometimes when you yourself said that even allowing Hindi had won most of South India.
No, he most of the Deccan. The Deccan, not South India. The Deccan. So, all right, first of all, we're really not talking about the Northwest. We're talking about the whole of the Indian subcontinent, in which even the obvious, evidently foreign rulers who come from outside are limited, are very few. Secondly, what is our definition of foreign rule? If you look at the Indian sources, for example, the Puran, they don't talk about these people as foreign rulers. They don't go as far as the coming of the Turks and the Afghans, but certainly the earlier rulers. They are willing to accept the Yavanas, the Kushan, all these people as perfectly in keeping with the whole dynastic list, dynastic history that they're giving of every other ruler in the country. And the definition again is one which we as historians use, is that if a group of people come in, even as conquerors, settle down, marry, and their children grow up in that region, and these people do not go back to where they originally came from, they become part of the population. And this is precisely the point, that we are today a very mixed population. You have innumerable caste names of very self-respecting Hindus and Sikhs, like Hoon, Kakkar. These are all originally Central Asians and Afghans. But today nobody says they're Central Asian and Afghans. We regard them as good Hindu jatis or good Muslim castes, because the Kakkars are also Muslim castes in Pakistan, as much as the Kakkars are Hindu jatis in Punjab and Central India. So that one has to be very careful about this business of saying foreign rule. These are all people who've been internalized in Indian society. Similarly, the Turks and the Afghans, they come in, they settle down, they marry here. We talk about the Mughals as foreign rulers. In fact, most of the Mughal kings are three quarters Indian because they all had Rajput mothers. So where is the evidence now of the Kushans having been foreign? Yes, they come from, right, they come from across the border, the present-day border of India that we recognize, and they're completely assimilated. So my objection is really to saying that we were constantly being ruled by foreign rulers. That is what is an incorrect.
What I'm saying is, we have been alternately having over the last 2,000 years, alternately we have been foreign rulers.
No, I'm sorry, that is unacceptable to the historian.